So I'm going to talk about sympathetic joy and equanimity a bit, and then we'll see what happens next. Sympathetic joy, again, is that ability to rejoice in the happiness of others, to feel happy when we see someone's success or good fortune, rather than be so overcome by envy or jealousy. People often ask if, basically, if sympathetic joy or the development, the cultivation of sympathetic joy means giving up one's values and one's principles and common sense. Like, am I supposed to be happy because this person made a lot of money even though they, like, destroyed the earth? And the answer is, well, no. That's not the point. The point is really to overcome either our predisposition for feeling that we don't have enough and we will never have enough, or our tendency to see happiness as a limited commodity, and therefore the more someone else has, the less we will have, or our fear, our sense of aloneness, our sense of deprivation. Like any practice of generosity, and this is definitely a practice of generosity, it does connect us to that sense of inner abundance. And if we have primarily a feeling of deprivation, we're not going to have it to give. And so we will be consumed by reflection on what we don't have, rather than have this ability to take delight in the happiness of others. So here again, I go to the Dalai Lama, who said it very well, I think. He said, it only makes sense to cultivate happiness in the happiness of others, because that increases our own chance of happiness 6 billion to 1. He said, those are very good odds. And I often think of it, some people call it like the poor man's happiness, like, you don't have to spend any money, you don't have to do anything, you don't even have to get dressed in the morning. You just have to think about someone else's happiness, you're filled with happiness, you're done. There it is. It is a state that I think we can understand the nature of the state, the beauty of the state, by reflecting on what it's like when we receive it or we don't. You know, sometimes something really good happens for you and some people are so happy for you, and it feels so great that they're taking delight in your accomplishment or your success. Whereas with some other people, it's like they may smile, but you really get the feeling. They would be just fine if it all fell apart for you. And it feels so diminishing. It's so painful to think that, wow, they're resentful of this great thing. And I think another thing to bear in mind always is what's realistic. You know, if we're sitting and fuming about someone else's success or good fortune, it's actually not going to make it go away. That's just not real. But we're sitting there filled with resentment, so we're suffering 10 times as much as we were before. So out of the greatest compassion for ourselves, not because we're, you know, trying to be picture perfect or self-righteous or anything, but out of enormous compassion for ourselves, we can cultivate relinquishing, seeing more clearly, actually having happiness in the happiness of others. When, you know, not when it's nonsensical, not when someone's really causing harm, but enjoying themselves mightily anyway, because actually we wouldn't ultimately consider that happiness. You know, but when it's really our own obstacle, like in the example of my not being correct in the advice that I gave, the example I told this morning. You know, it was such a release to just think, you know what, your trip went really well, I'm so happy for you, rather than having all of my attention centering around the point of my advice. So to let go of some of that self-preoccupation and to really be happy. It's not going to take anything away from us. And we can recognize in the end that someone else's happiness is our happiness. The far enemy of sympathetic joy, of course, is jealousy or envy. The near enemy I've seen described in different ways. Some texts describe it as giddiness, just kind of being happy for no good reason. More relevant in my mind was a description I've seen of the near enemy of sympathetic joy being a state of comparison, where we're kind of checking out other people, not for the sake of being happy for them, but more to try to figure out who we are relative to who they are. And it's interesting, in the Buddhist psychology, the state of comparing is considered unwholesome or unskillful, which means a state of suffering, no matter what conclusion we draw. We may decide we're better than somebody or worse than they are, or equal to them. And in any of those cases, the very act of comparing in that way is considered unskillful, because it's a kind of gnawing restlessness, agitation, and it's endless. So sometimes we joke in the context of a retreat. You know, so let's say you're sitting here and you're trying to figure out if you're a better meditator or a worse meditator than everybody sitting around you, let's just say. And of course we don't know. But given that lack of knowledge, we can only use very abstract and usually meaningless measures, like, did they move during the sitting or not? You know, so maybe you're sitting there in the middle of the sitting and someone moves, and you think, oh, good. They moved. I'm a better meditator than they are. Okay. And you think, but wait a minute. When I came in from lunch, they were already sitting here. Maybe they sat all the way through lunch. They didn't even have lunch. They sat all the way through lunch and through this last little sitting. I'm much worse than they are. Right? And then we kind of figure it out in terms of everyone sitting around us, and then someone new comes in and we think, uh-oh, where are they sitting? You know, can I possibly feel over 8 seats back to see if they move or not? You know, it's just constant. Constant. So it's that kind of aching restlessness, you know, agitation. That's what makes it unskillful, no matter what conclusion we draw. And so it's got certain similarities to sympathetic joy in that we're noticing the situation of somebody, but it's not for the sake of being happy for them. It's really to figure out who we are, if we deserve to be alive, even relative to what we see in them. So, and now I'll go back actually and just do the proximate causes, which I sort of mentioned with loving kindness anyway. The proximate cause or nearest arising factor for loving kindness is seeing the good in someone, whether ourselves or others, or that reflection on all beings wanting to be happy. The proximate cause of compassion is seeing suffering. We need to see it for what it is. We need to see suffering as suffering. So when we're looking at our own anger, fear, jealousy, greed, for example, rather than calling those states bad or wrong or terrible, or considering ourselves bad or wrong or terrible people for having those states, we see them as states of suffering. We actually make that translation. And then compassion can arise. And so, too, when we look at others, we need to open to the reality of suffering. And this is very, very difficult. By and large, we're not trained for this. We're heavily conditioned toward the opposite. Let's look the other way. Let's pretend. Let's just ignore them. They make me uncomfortable. Or I can fix this in a day and a half, or, you know, something like that. It's very difficult to just be there and acknowledge, yeah, that hurts. I'm sure. And yet that is the springboard for compassion to be able to arise. And the proximate cause of sympathetic joy is seeing joy, seeing happiness, seeing our own happiness, seeing that happiness is more bountiful than we might normally assume when we think they got it all yesterday. Now there's nothing left. It's making a point, especially in the balance, which also has to happen between compassion and sympathetic joy, making the point to open to both suffering and joy, both pain and pleasure, because they need one another, compassion and sympathetic joy. If we only open to the suffering, after a while, likely we will get too tired. It's too much. We'll lose the equanimity factor and we'll burn out. If we only are willing to open to the pleasure or the joy, that's just silly, because that means avoiding more and more and more and more and more of what's actually happening in life. And yet we need the energy, the upliftment, the resourcefulness of the pleasure or the joy. It can be a very simple thing. You know, seeing the light on the flower. Something very simple, not to be ignored. Because it will lift our spirits and remind us of the pleasure that also exists. They need each other. And we need to cultivate both, in a way. And then comes the last of the Brahmaviharas, which is the state of equanimity. Equanimity means balance, as we've been talking about. It's the kind of balance, I like to talk about it as the voice of wisdom. The articulation of wisdom is the kind of balance that comes from seeing clearly. It comes from understanding that this is life. That I will do everything I possibly can to try to make a difference. And may not be exactly as I pictured in my timetable. That's life. So the way the Buddha described it was talking about eight vicissitudes which make up the fabric of life. It's pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. It's pleasure and pain, praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute. And he said, that's how it is. It's the very fabric of life. There's nobody who experiences only pleasure with no pain. There's no one who experiences only praise with no blame. It's just not in the nature of things. I can remember many years ago, I was hiking with these friends in California in a state park. And we decided we were going to hike in for 3 days and then on the fourth day, turn around and take the identical path out. So this was still the third day and we were going in. And it turned out to be a day of many, many hours of very, very steady downhill walking. And the friend that I was with and I, it's almost like we were struck by a simultaneous realization and we both just stopped. And he said to me, in a dualistic universe, downhill can only mean one thing. And sure enough, the next day when we turned around, it was many, many, many hours of very steady uphill walking. And that's not to say that on every level it's a dualistic universe, but on the level in which we know pleasure and pain, that's the truth of things. We go up and we go down. It's never one direction. We have pleasure, we have pain. It can be a very quick succession. Over and over again. It's pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. And it's not something that evens out, necessarily. Sometimes people think, well, if I meditate hard enough, you know, it's too bad the pleasure will go away, but the pain will go away too. And it'll just be this kind of gray blob. But it's not like that. And they say the Buddha, as an example, had backaches. So the nature of the body, he had backaches. One assumes, you know, he didn't do what that guy did with the tension in his jaw and say, oh, you know, I'm such a terrible person and it always is going to be that way. So he didn't maybe have that mental anguish. But his back hurt. It's in the nature of life. Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. So for one thing, when we say, may I be happy, it has a very different meaning than may I only experience pleasure, because that's totally unrealistic. Maybe not even desirable. And for another, there is wisdom that accompanies all of our efforts to make this a better world. There can be wisdom that accompanies all of our efforts to make this a better world, to be happier people ourselves, to understand that the deepest happiness won't be the complete vanquishing of any painful experience. It's just not going to happen. But that's okay. Because we can have a very, very different sense of happiness, from balance, from wisdom, from love, which in the end is going to be what sustains us. And we all know that. It's like the power of the mind. It's not to say circumstances aren't very powerful, because they can be extremely powerful. But we all also know that, you know, maybe we've been in a beautiful situation, like in Hawaii, beautiful waterfall surrounded by friends, but we're afraid or we're depressed. We don't feel that good. And if people are reaching out to try to help us, we wouldn't even notice them because we're so absorbed in that downward spiral. Or maybe we or others we know have been in times of great adversity, tremendous challenge, but we're filled with faith, or we're in love, or we have a strong sense of not being alone, of being together with someone who's reaching out to help us, or we're reaching out to help, even as we face our own difficulty. And it's different. So even in, you know, terrible time, there is a certain power of mind that we can access, we can really utilize. So our sense of happiness is much more about that than the complete elimination of pain somehow, someday. There's pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. And I always like to sort of emphasize the praise and blame part, because I think it's so interesting to look at how we can do just the same thing and some people will praise us and some people will blame us. And that's not to say we don't care or we don't notice. I mean, of course we care. But how much do we care becomes the question. As the Buddha said, there's always blame in this world. He said if you say nothing, some people will blame you. If you say a lot, some people will blame you. If you say just a little bit, some people will blame you. There's always blame in this world. And the story that goes along with that is from the time of the Buddha, when apparently a man came to the monastery wanting to learn something of what the Buddha taught. And the first person he came upon was a monk who'd taken a temporary vow of silence. So when he was asked, will you tell me something of what the Buddha teaches, he remained silent. And the man got really furious and stomped away. So the same man came back a second day and came upon another disciple of the Buddha's, who was a monk who was famous not just for his meditative accomplishment, but for his great theoretical understanding. And so the man asked him, will you tell me something of what the Buddha teaches? And he went into a very elaborate theoretical description, and the man got furious and stomped away. So the same man came back a third day, came upon another disciple of the Buddha, this monk named Ananda. And they say, Ananda, having heard what happened on the first day and what happened on the second day, was careful to say something, but not too much. And the man got really angry. And he said, how dare you treat such profound matters so sketchily, and stomped away. So this group of people went off to see the Buddha, and they said, oh Lord Buddha, this is what happened on the first day. This is what happened on the second day. This is what happened on the third day. What do you have to say? And the Buddha said, there's always blame in this world. Mm-hmm. If you say nothing, some people will blame you. If you say just a little bit, some people will blame you. If you say a lot, some people will blame you. There's always blame in this world. But that doesn't mean we're indifferent to that. Equanimity, the far enemy of equanimity is reaction. It's attachment and aversion. Attachment or aversion. The near enemy of equanimity is indifference. So equanimity does not mean indifference. It's not cold. Sometimes indifference is actually a subtle form of sullenness or hostility, real withdrawal, pulling away, not caring. And equanimity is nothing like that. It's really a spacious stillness that comes from understanding. So the reason, you know, I go back to praise and blame all the time is because it is the very same activity that can produce either. Now I want to bring in another model for a moment, which is the model that's used to describe action that we undertake. So the first and a very, very critical element of anything we do or anything we say is the intention or the motivation behind it. And that is considered very potent. And unlike Western understanding, in all Eastern traditions really, knowing our motive and acting from the best intention or motive that we possibly can is considered a critical facet of any action that we take. So let's say I decided to give one of you this chocolate bar. All anybody sees is my hand moving down and picking up an object, moving it forward, right? But what's the heart space? What's the intention? What's the motivation that sparked that action to begin with? Maybe I like you, and I want you to have it. So I say, here, have a chocolate bar. Maybe I don't like you. And I think, well, it's milk chocolate. I understand you actually don't like milk chocolate. But you're not going to be able to refuse it in this crowd of people. So I can say, here, have a chocolate bar. Or maybe I see you have a bigger chocolate bar. And I think, well, maybe if I give you this, you'll give me that. Or maybe I just gave a whole big talk on generosity. And I think, well, maybe I'm often a very generous person. Here, I'll have a chocolate bar. You know, it looks identical on the surface. My hand moving down, picking up an object, moving it forward, maybe smile. But it's actually considered a different action because of the different motivation that may be guiding it. So we can know our motivation. The more mindful we get, the more we can pay attention to intention. Why did I do that? What was coming up for me that I made that offering? So mindfulness will help us kind of sort out our motivation. And it said that, even in the teachings, it said that a practice like loving kindness meditation will help transform our field of motivation. And interestingly enough, the research is confirming that. It's like the part of the brain or whatever that is like the field of intention or motivation is what seems to be transformed in doing a loving kindness or compassion meditation. So, for example, if in general we have been coming from a place of fear in what we do or what we say, and we do loving kindness meditation, over time we will find that we are coming from a place of connection. It's just we're motivated differently So that's the first part of an action, is the motivation or intention. The second part, you could say, is like the execution phase. It's the skillfulness or unskillfulness of the action, which is really based on context. It's like the immediacy of what we sense in the moment is the most skillful way to go about something. So, for example, if out of a genuinely beautiful motive I want to give someone this chocolate bar, I might stop for a moment and think, well, you know, there's only one chocolate bar. Maybe I should do this privately. Maybe I should try to take you aside and, you know, just do it off in a corner or something like that. Maybe that's the most skillful way. So that's based on a bigger sense of mindfulness, like mindfulness of context, discernment, understanding, wisdom. Sometimes I call it our best guess of what's most skillful in a certain situation. And I think it's important to be able to distinguish those two, the intention and the skillfulness of the execution or the action. Because when we conflate the two, then it becomes, then we get a sense often that if you're going to come from a loving place, you just have this narrow little band of activity available to you as an expression of that love, like smiling, saying yes, giving away everything, having everybody move into your apartment, whatever it might be, you know. But really, we may genuinely be coming from a very loving motive, and our best sense of what's most appropriate, most skillful in a certain situation might be pretty fierce, might be very intense, it might be saying no. Ram Dass's guru, Neem Karoli Baba, who was a great teacher in India, used to have this saying, which went something like, never throw anyone out of your heart. Never throw anyone out of your heart. And one of my colleagues, my friend, Sylvia Borstein, had a kind of addendum to that, where she said, never throw anyone out of your heart. You might throw them out of your life, but never throw them out of your heart. It's kind of like that. You know, we can get so afraid that, you know, were we to really be coming from a more and more loving place, we turn into these kind of meek creatures who can't really, you know, stand up for ourselves or anybody else. But those are really two different aspects. And we need a lot of wisdom, a lot of discernment, a lot of learning. Both those aspects are very malleable. We can change our motivation, our field of motivation. We can learn more and more skill. We can learn from our mistakes. We can learn, for example, skills of communication, ways to express, you know, being truthful, being appropriate in what we say. And then there's a third aspect of action, which you could say is the immediate result. And ironically, since those first two arenas are places where we can continue to learn and grow, the immediate result, which we cannot affect, tends to be the place where we really place our heart to try to decide if we have integrity, if what we've done was good, who we are. And yet, you know, here's the place where praise and blame comes in. Maybe out of a beautiful motive, I decide to give you this chocolate bar, and I think about it really carefully, I'm very sensitive. I figure, okay, I am going to take you aside. I don't have enough for everybody, so I'm going to take you aside and do it this way, and I'm going to, you know, say this when I do it. But maybe you just checked your cell phone messages during the lunch break and you just found out you won, you know, $10 million in the lottery. It's like you could not care less about this chocolate bar. But I hand it to you and you go, oh, thanks. And you're gone. So how often in that moment do we consider, you know, every moment is a confluence of conditions coming together. I don't know what mood you're in. I don't know what might be affecting your level of gratitude. Very rarely. Mostly we think, I'm an idiot. I can't believe I did that. Why do I always give bad gifts? Why is it always a chocolate bar? Really? Why can't I choose better? Why didn't I notice they didn't want chocolate? I must be allergic. I'm a fool. You know, whatever it might be. And so, and it's not to say we don't care. Again, of course we care. We would like to be thanked. We would like someone to express gratitude. That's human nature. That's appropriate. But when our sense of ourselves is built on getting thanked, only getting praise, we're lost. Because we cannot control the unfolding of events. Because you can't say to someone, you know, at 10 of 3, 10 to 3, have I to say here, at 10 to 3, something is going to happen. So please don't check your cell phone. Don't check your email. Don't have a conversation with anybody before you come in the room. And don't think of anything. I want you to come into the room as a completely blank slate. Because something is going to happen. Life's not like that. So even as we care, the question is, how much do we care? And can we have some balance? Can we have some equanimity? Born of wisdom, born of perspective. So there's always blame in this world. And it's quite interesting to look back at those experiences where you receive both praise and blame for the very same thing. You know, sometimes it is important to look back at our motivation, to see where we were coming from, to look back at the skillfulness of our action. I mean, of course that's true, but to think, there was a way to do it so perfectly so that every single person in the universe would praise me. It's like, it is not going to happen. And we suffer so much from believing that it could be so. I remember when my first book, Loving Kindness, came out. There's a much more modern version of it. It's gone through all these different, you know, little version, big version. If you ever see the original hardcover version and look on the back, it's very interesting because it took me a very long time to write that book. My entire life I'd wanted to be a writer and I never thought I could do it. And many of my colleagues wrote books after we began teaching and not me. Finally, the book came out. And you can tell it took a long time because if you look on the back for the original blurbs, the comments, somebody said something like, we've waited a long time for this book. And someone else said, in this long-awaited first book. And someone else said something like, Sharon Salzberg has finally given it. And I made the publisher take out the finally. Too much. But it took me a really long time to write the book. And it was such an amazing moment when it finally came out. And not long after it came out, I went to California. And I was having lunch with somebody. And she said to me, you know, Sharon, you wrote that book in such a way, it's just like being with you. It's like sitting down having a conversation with you. And I was so thrilled. I thought, wow, I bet there's not a nicer thing you can say to a writer. That must be the best compliment a writer could ever get. And I was so jazzed by the comment that night I was having dinner with a whole other group of people. And I brought it up. I brought up the comment. And someone at the dinner table said, well, that's not true. So, I'm reading the book. It doesn't sound anything like you. It's nothing like being with you. And I thought, okay, you can be ecstatic at lunch and depressed at dinner. Or you could take a moment and remember they're talking about the same book that was written from whatever was motivating me at the time, with whatever level of skill I could bring forth at the time. One person felt one way about it, another person felt another way about it. It's the same book. And of course I cared. I was much happier at lunch than I was. But again, the question is, how much do we care? Do we have like such an overriding sense of futility about our effort at dinner? Forgetting that this is in the nature of things. And it's good to look back at the level of skill with which we've executed something. But it's never going to be that it's only praise. It's just not. So we need a whole other means in a way to assess our integrity, which has to do with our motivation, which has to do with our continually evolving level of skill. Because those are the arenas we can grow and change. So the immediate reaction is going to be complex. It just is. And here, remember, equanimity doesn't mean indifference, but it means balance. The balance born of wisdom. And then there's a certain amount of that that has to do with that sense of immediacy of result. Because here again, you know, many, many things we do are really like planting seeds. And we're not going to see the fruit right away. And we need to let go of that need to see the fruit right away or just discount what we've done. Things may take their own time. Healing may have its own rhythm. Life evolves in its own way. It's very intricate, this confluence of conditions coming together. If we don't plant the seed, maybe nothing will happen. So it's very important that we do what we can do in this moment, in this time, whatever it is, however small it may seem, because everything is connected. It all evolves and grows and changes. So if we don't do even this little bit, things may take a radically different course. But we also can't demand that it's all complete in that moment. You know, there have been many times, usually when I use this example, I don't even have a chocolate bar handy, so I usually talk about a book. And there have been many times when actually I've given someone a book, you know, not necessarily one I've written at all, but just given someone a book, and I do sense a kind of cool response, like, oh, thanks. And, they walk away. And not uncommonly, sometimes years later, someone will come up to me and say, you know, you gave me that book, and in all honesty, it didn't really resonate with me right away, but I have this whole other situation happening now in my life where, you know, my mother is ill or I've lost my job or even that there's this extraordinary opportunity that's opening up in front of me and I feel very timid about going for it. And I picked up the book and it was really perfect. So we don't know. We really don't know so much. I once decided, I haven't done it yet, but I once decided I wanted to write a book called Basically Clueless because of how much we don't know and yet evolves over time. So we need to do the good that's in front of us, even if it seems very small, and have some equanimity about that time frame, that sense of immediacy because of the mystery that is actually the truth of how things are connected and how they unfold and so on. So there's always blame as well as praise happening. And we can't actually corral the flow of time to say just when we will see the fruit of some action. That's why we need equanimity. And so we use practices like the deepening of loving kindness and compassion for the transformation of our motivation. And we use practices like the deepening of equanimity to be able to sustain our efforts in our lives through all of the inevitable ups and downs and changes. Because that's just in the nature of things. It's not like apathy. It's not like complacency. It's very full-hearted. It's very present. It's very open. But with this big sense of space. Because we understand that this is actually how things are. So it said that equanimity will endow loving kindness with patience, that it will endow compassion with courage, and that it will allow sympathetic joy to really expand beyond the relatively narrow confines, usually, of who we feel is kind of on our team, that we can be happy for, and expand into a much more inclusive, open state. So they all work together in those ways. Okay. The proximate cause of equanimity will be that kind of understanding of the eight vicissitudes, seeing the truth of change, seeing what we cannot control, seeing an equality between beings in the end, things like that. It's all wisdom based in some way. All right.